Welcome to this episode of Just the Disc. My name's Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have my good friend John Cribbs joining me one more time on the show. John, thank you so much for coming back. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Great to be back.
Always a pleasure, sir. Always a pleasure. I have told people off air and on Twitter that the episodes that you and I have done together are some of my favorite episodes, and I always, you know, get a kick out of the insights that you bring to these discussions. You know, always good stuff. So thank you.
Oh, same here, sir. Of course. I mean, you know, since the video store days, you know, you find that guy who's knowledgeable enough and fun enough to talk about movies with, and that's who you just want to keep going back to, and that is you for me, sir.
Well, and 100%. You're the same, man. It's great. It's a mutual appreciation for sure. So you had come up, I think you came up with this, or maybe we worked out the idea, but I feel like it was kind of your idea. We were going to do this. We've got right now in front of us, we've got a pile of discs, six to be exact, and they are all from Kino Lorber Studio Classics. And
yes.
I think we started throwing together some ideas about which ones to cover, and it's a really interesting mixed bag of stuff. We've got some thrillers, we've got a Western, we've got a heist movie. So this should be fun, I think.
Yeah, what they have in common is that they are all great. I really like all of these movies. And Kino, in particular, has just been killing it this year. I mean, they've obviously been great ever since going back to re-releases of Fritz Lang and Buster Keaton. I mean, their whole history. But it just seems like this year, every time I think that there can't possibly be any more surprises, they announce a new slate of movies. That's like, wow. There's always at least one film in there that you're just so excited that's finally going to be available in a beautiful new format that's going to have really cool new extra features on it. The last time we talked, actually, it was about their release of For a Few Dollars More, which was absolutely fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
And since then, they've just had so much new stuff. And, you know, unfortunately, one of the more recent things, contractually, they had to lose the special features on their Lost Highway disc.
That was a bummer.
It was, but luckily, Tim Lucas, at least, was able to make his commentary available on his blog for people to go and listen to if they want to.
What?
And yeah.
I did not know that. Is it still available?
It is, yeah. Okay. Just go over to Tim Lucas's blog and you can play it along with the movie.
Holy shit.
And it's just as good as you would expect. And I'm hoping that Nick Pinkerton, who is able to publish his booklet somewhere, the piece that he wrote for the release that they had to take away after they checked and saw that David Lynch wasn't going to allow any extras to be on the disc. I'm hoping that he finds some place to put that. I'd love to hear his thoughts on the movie as well.
Well, I am so glad you said that. You totally scooped me on this, and for some reason I did not know that Tim Lucas had made that available on his blog, so I am going to zip right over there and get that commentary, because I was really crestfallen about that. I was like, that is such a horrible loss that we aren't going to be able to hear that, and I hoped in my heart that there would be a way, but I never even thought about the fact that he probably owns it and he can do whatever he wants with it. It's probably not an exclusive deal kind of thing. So that is fantastic news.
I'm guessing so, but I also like to think that, you know, Kino deserves some props. I'm sure he probably wants to maintain a good relationship with them. He probably talked to them at some point to say, can I make this available? And
said,
yeah, go right ahead. You know, you did the work. You might as well put it out there. So,
well, that's great.
That's so exciting.
Yeah, he's been one of the great things about Kino lately is how much they've brought him into the fold to talk about, obviously, Mario Bava. We know that that's his bread and butter. But, he, you know, on the Western discs and, you know, they're just bringing him in to do all kinds of stuff. And to give all kinds of different movies the Tim Lucas treatment is just such a wonderful catnip thing to do for cinephiles that I got to give them props for that. That's really, really good stuff.
Absolutely.
I don't think we have any Lucas commentaries in this mix, unfortunately.
Sadly, no. But some good commentaries nonetheless.
Absolutely.
Really great commentators.
The aforementioned Mr. Pinkerton is in the mix, and so that's good stuff. Well, let's get into this here. So I'm going to run down the list just so we know what we're talking about. We're going to start with The Silent Partner. We're going to go into Midnight Lace, followed by Link, followed by Bend of the River, followed by The Man Who Haunted Himself, and closing out with Robbery, Peter Yates' film Robbery. So let's get into this here, sir. Talk about, you know, movies that I could not wait to be on Blu-ray. right at the top of the stack here, The Silent Partner. I mean, this is a movie that we have talked about on Pure Cinema for a long time, and I know you've been a fan of. It's just one of those great late 70s thrillers.
Did you get her home all right? She's very attractive.
Who is this?
Now, that's the beautiful part of it, isn't it? I know who you are, but you're in the dark. Well, not totally in the dark. I've left your light on for you. By the way, do you have much luck with those chest problems? Look, why don't you come over to the window and open the curtains, and then we can have a look at each other. Go on, open them.
If you have something to say to me, say it, otherwise I'm hanging up.
Oh, no, don't hang up now, pal. I'm running low on dimes, and I just have to come up there, that's all, and I don't want to do that, not yet. Now, first, we're going to try to talk things over reasonably, right? Now, come over to the window.
That's better.
Friends. You know that? Friends. I mean it.
You know, you're kind of remarkable, you know that? I don't know how you managed to pull it off. Well, I guess you're going to have to tell me one of these days.
But we worked it together, didn't we?
I mean, we ran the same risks, didn't we? We're partners.
I'm going to call the police.
And what are you going to tell them? Besides,
you see this?
Oh, come on. You don't think I'm going to shoot you from here, do you?
That, I think, partially due to availability, but maybe partially due to it being a lower-budget Canadian production. I don't know. It just never really found its way to the, you know, mainstream cinephile spigot, if you will. And, boy, I couldn't be happier that this is on disc.
And I could be happier that I'm the one who gets to talk about it on this show. I feel like this particular release has come up in the last five or six episodes of Just the Disc, because everyone is so excited to own it and to get it on Blu-ray finally. I still have my ridiculous DVD.
Me too.
With the cover that looks like some Tarantino knockoff.
Or
like,
Ocean's 11 or some shit.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
It just has like these nondescript guys in suits walking around with guns like a bunch of gangsters. And you're like, who approved this freaking cover?
It's just like something where they're like, what is this movie? How do we sell? I don't know. Let's just make it look like something else. And
it's like they didn't even watch it.
No. All you had to do was put Christopher Plummer in the Santa suit with the gun on the cover. I mean, like, that sells the movie in and of itself, you know?
So many great possibilities that you could use from this movie. Put John Candy on the cover.
Oh, yes.
I mean, geez, anything.
Yes. So, okay. So for people that don't know, Silent Partner is a really great little sleeper directed by Daryl Duke of Payday fame, who I love Payday. And I hope
Hell yeah.
that gets a Blu-ray at some point. But so he directed it. It's a script by Mr. Curtis Hanson, who RIP, great writer and filmmaker. And it stars Elliot Gould and Christopher Plummer. And the basic plot is that Gould plays a bank teller who happens to, through circumstance, discover that Christopher Plummer is going to rob his bank. And he does something. I don't want to spoil too much if I don't have to, I guess. He does something to kind of mess up Christopher Plummer's plans. And then it becomes sort of a cat and mouse between Plummer and Gould. And boy, you have not seen a character quite as evil as Christopher Plummer in this movie in a long time, I'll tell you.
I hope you didn't go to any trouble on my account. I'm not going to break the door down. I'm just going to give you a little time to try to be reasonable. If you decide you're not going to be reasonable, then one night when you come home, you'll find me on the inside, waiting for you. And that'll be the night you'll wish you'd never been born.
So even though I don't think it's spoiling anything because it's right off the bat, he appears as Santa. It's yes. The very first thing that happens. So
yes.
You have an evil Santa Claus in this movie.
Yeah.
Who becomes even worse, you know, once he takes off the Santa getup, because he seems kind of, you know, innocuous, even, you know, up to the point where he's going to rob the bank because he's Saint Nick and he's in this ridiculous costume. But then, yeah, as soon as he takes it off, it's like, wow, it's one of the most dangerous characters ever put on screen.
Yeah, I think it's a really great performance. Well, performances all around. You know who I forgot to mention is the female lead, which is Susanna York. And she works at the bank with Elliot Gould, and she's great, and she's very exasperated by his character, who is, like, kind of all over the place once he gets in the mix with the Christopher Plummer character. But I don't know, what do you think of the performances across the board?
Oh, across the board, fantastic yeah. performances. Yeah. And it's funny, this time, something that I've always wanted from this movie is the black Superman lunchbox that Gould uses to siphon off his share of the money that he's going to run away with. And I realized watching it this time, oh, this was the same year that Susanna York played Superman's mom.
Oh my gosh, well caught, sir, well caught. Wow, I definitely wouldn't have put that.
But she is great. Gould is amazing. It's amazing, this movie, how easy it is for him to play schnook and suave back and forth.
Yes.
You know, a confident, you know, planner, and also, you know, can get the upper hand in situations by playing dumb. You know, people believe that he's just some bank teller and exotic fish collector, and he's not, you know, got nothing going on other than that. But when he puts the cut the shit face on, he's so formidable and confident, you know, and all the women in this movie are into him.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
And both are very believable.
Yeah.
So he just does, he really offers a lot of dimension to this character. I first found out about this movie through the Video Movie Guide growing up. You know, the Martin and Porter guide. I didn't have, you know, Danny Perry growing up, unfortunately. But this is one of those movies that I discovered because they gave it like a 4 or 5 star review. This movie I'd never heard of, and went to the video store and found, you know, the crappy video copy of it. And I would call it one of the best movies of the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if someone says, you know, what are the best films of the 70s, it'd be like top 5 just off the top of my head. It's really just the epitome of a sleeper, you know, something that people have discovered through video guides and through word of mouth, you know, over the years. And like we said, it's gotten all these crappy releases up to now, and now it's finally getting the respect that it deserves. So it's really terrific.
Yeah, no, I'm with you 100%. It defines the word sleeper. And I did discover it through Danny Perry and his Guide for the Film Fanatic, which is my favorite, probably my favorite book of all time, if I'm being honest. And it's not even listed in the back. It gets a proper write-up in the book, and that was one of the things that got my attention, was his little, you know, paragraph or two about it in Guide for the Film Fanatic. And it was on, like, a Vestron. No, it wasn't Vestron. It was some other sort of obscure video label, and I was able to track down a VHS of it. But the highlight for me in seeing this movie, outside of this Blu-ray, which is great, was seeing it at the New Bev with Elric around Christmas in 2018.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we saw it with a full house. It was a double feature, Die Hard and The Silent Partner, which they've apparently done before, last year or 2 years ago. I don't remember when, but really great double feature and highly recommended. Even though you wouldn't necessarily think those movies go together, it was actually a perfect double bill. The print was fine. It wasn't great. This Blu-ray puts it to shame, but seeing it with the crowd really highlighted how awesome the movie is, and to hear people reacting to it, especially to some of the very grisly violence that seems to almost come out of nowhere, except for the fact that you know that Christopher Plummer is really fucking evil and that he's capable of bad stuff, but some of the stuff he does end up doing is pretty alarming. So, yeah, that was just a great experience overall. But what did you think of the features on this one? We've got an interview with Elliot Gould, and then a commentary with film historians Howard Berger, Steve Mitchell, and Nathaniel Thompson.
I think they're great. I think the interview with Gould is fantastic. I'm a little bit bummed that they didn't include Kim Morgan's excellent interview of him in this about this film specifically. Although you can go to on her blog and read that anytime you want. But he covers a lot of the same anecdotes in this interview. He obviously loves the film. He has a great fondness for it. He was obviously a big champion for it at the time. He talks a lot about the distribution issues and the reason why we didn't see this in theaters in America. Just sounds like a really shady kind of deal.
Yeah.
So you kind of get some insight into that. And the scene you were just talking about, again, not to spoil anything, but the kind of horrific violence that happens in the middle of the movie. It's funny, when I get to that scene, when I watch this film, because it's such a fun film and such a laid-back kind of movie up to that point, that it kind of really hits you on the head. You know, it really kind of comes out of nowhere, and I'm always kind of wondering how they got away with that, because yeah. it's really something that could, I think, pull people out of the movie if it weren't done well. So it's interesting that Gould reveals something I didn't know, which was that Daryl Duke refused to direct that scene. That he left the production before it happened, and apparently Curtis Hanson was the one who stepped in and actually directed that scene. So that kind of adds an interesting layer there, to have this really unsettling moment. They had to bring in someone else to direct it because Duke didn't want to put it into the movie. And I can see his argument. I can see how he'd be worried that he would lose the audience at that moment.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting to hear that they actually wanted to put it in there so badly that they got Hanson to do it instead.
Yeah, I'm torn because ultimately it really resonates in the film, and it raises the stakes at a point when I feel like the movie needs to raise the stakes. And so on a structural level, you know, it is shocking, but it works. So I don't fault Daryl Duke for that, but yeah.
Yeah, it definitely works. I should say that. You know, I'm not conflicted about that scene being in there at all. But I think if everything up to then wasn't pitch perfect, then it wouldn't have worked. I think if the relationship between Gould's character and Plummer's character wasn't so richly drawn and so perfectly woven up to that point, that, you know, it definitely could have been a failure.
Yeah.
I mean, these are two characters who don't actually meet physically so that they could touch each other until the last 15 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, they're always separated by being on opposite ends of a telephone or by a door. So the fact that they have this connection in this movie is the strength, is the whole film. It's the whole strength of the narrative, that they can make this amazing connection between these two characters who are almost completely separated for most of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. The Gould stuff I took down here was from his interview. He talks about Daryl Duke saying, "I don't want to see any of you in the picture," which Gould didn't quite understand at first. But if you watch the movie, you see, I mean, there is some of the suave Gould, but there's a lot of this nebbish character that's very much the anti-Gould of that period. And I thought that was an interesting observation. He said that Spielberg called and said he saw the movie and it was really good. He said that Gould thought that his friend Mick Jagger would have been great in the Plummer role. I don't disagree, but I just don't think he could top Plummer personally. And then he also talks about Peter O'Toole meeting him at a gathering in Canada while shooting the movie, and that they talked about Richard Rush, and he assured O'Toole that Rush was a great director to work with, as O'Toole was at the time considering working with him on The Stuntman. So Gould may have facilitated the stuntman being as good as it is because of O'Toole, and that's intriguing, I think. You know,
so that's just Elliot Gould working overtime, you know, just being in all these amazing films from the 70s, but also making sure another amazing film from the 70s was getting made.
Yeah, absolutely. We should move along here real quick, but anything from the commentary that stood out to you? I didn't have any notes on it. I enjoyed it, but I didn't have notes.
I had the same kind of reaction. I really enjoyed the commentary. It's my kind of thing where they don't really target specific scenes and talk about specific scenes. They kind of have an overlapping sort of thing that they talk about. They kind of stick to themes that they're interested in. So it's kind of a loose conversation. I know you, in your recent episode, you had mentioned that you thought maybe it was a Skyped conversation between everybody. Did you get that impression? Yeah.
Yeah. I think, and to be fair, like, I'm not trying to, when I mention that stuff, I'm not necessarily trying to be critical, because I'll be honest, I'll take a Skype conversation over nothing any day of the week. And Kino just putting it out there to these guys and saying, let's get this commentary done, and them doing it, I'm fine with whatever, you know? And we're used to that. I think at this day and age, we're used to Skype audio, and it's not a big deal. But it is something you notice from time to time when you plug into a commentary, or like initially like, oh, okay, that's what this is. Okay, no problem.
Yeah, I only bring it up because I didn't notice. You know,
oh,
I thought
interesting.
Actually it was pretty well done. So I wasn't, when I heard you say that on the episode, I thought, oh no, when I listen to this commentary, it's going to be a problem, but yeah, it didn't seem that bad.
I may be overly sensitive, and it may be wrong for that all I know, but I'm pretty sure...
Well, you just got the editor's ear, so
yeah. That might be it. But I mean, I'm pretty sure that they don't, all three of them live in the same area, so that was another thing that I was like, they must have Skyped somebody in. But anyway, yeah, it was enjoyable, and I do recommend it, and it's a great addition to this already wonderful disc, so...
And one of them is the director of King Cohen, I believe, the Larry Cohen documentary.
Oh, yes, that's Steve Mitchell, I think.
That's
great to have him there. All right, so that's Silent Partner. Obviously, a huge recommend from both of us, 100%. You know, this is a must-own. Moving on to Midnight Lace, the next one in our pile. This is another thriller. This is a bit more obscure. It is a Doris Day thriller with Rex Harrison and John Gavin. It's produced by Ross Hunter, who, and shot by Russell Meddy, by the way, so it has something in common with Douglas Sirk, which I think is interesting. It has a very shady Roddy McDowall as sort of a layabout.
the best kind of Roddy McDowall.
Yes, he's really good. He is the son of her housekeeper. They live in London. They are well-to-do. I think it's her money, am I mistaken?
Correct.
Yeah, it's her
money.
She's
got the money.
Mm-hmm. And... It's a thing where she starts getting menaced by some mysterious person. There's a really great opening scene that almost plays like a horror movie, and Kat Ellinger has a lot of... We'll get to her commentary in a second, but she has some great comments about the opening and how it's very gothic, and it's London fog thick as pea soup, and she hears this voice that's like, you know, talking about coming after her.
Mrs. Preston! Over here now, Mrs. Preston.
Who are you?
You'll know just before I kill you.
Tony, he said he was going to kill me.
Someone's been pulling your leg.
Who are you?
Mrs. Preston, can you think of anyone who might want to kill you?
No.
The story she told them sounded convincing. That every ring of the telephone meant shame and a threat of death. That unexplainable accidents happened wherever she went.
Look out below!
And yet they had every reason to doubt her.
Why don't you say what you're really thinking, Inspector?
What would that be, Mrs. Preston?
You don't believe me, do you? You think I made him up?
Starring Doris Day, in a role whose emotional power will surprise you. Rex Harrison, celebrated star of My Fair Lady. John Gavin, what game was he playing? Co-starring Myrna Loy, Roddy McDowall.
You've been threatening my life. I have to turn you over to the police.
And Herbert Marshall. In a suspense drama played in a world of fashion and elegance.
And then she starts to get these phone calls of this person threatening her. And it becomes a thing where after the first scene, I believe, where we do hear the voice, after that we don't hear the voice except we see her reacting to it. So it becomes a thing where we're like, okay, is this in her head? Is it not in her head? And her husband, Rex Harrison, is trying to believe her and play along, but he's definitely concerned about what's going on, and it's just sort of progresses and gets more and more amped up. Had you seen this? You had this on disc, I think, so you'd seen this before, right?
I had, yeah. I remember seeing it on TCM a few years ago and enjoying it. So getting it with a Doris Day set that came out on DVD a little while ago. So I had seen it. It was really fun to revisit it. It's such a dry thriller. It's as dry as Rex Harrison's martini, I tell you. It's just, I love a dry thriller, you know, and it's sort of, that dryness is sort of offset by Doris Day's performance. She really, we were talking about it earlier, really just hammers it home in this one. I mean, it's a very naked performance that she gives. I think her fear is really palpable in this film.
Yeah.
She's really terrorized, you know, and you, like you mentioned, we don't hear a lot of the things that she's hearing when this guy's calling her and threatening her and taunting her, but her reactions are just enough. Like, they do the trick. I'm not super familiar with where she was in her career at this point. That's why I was glad to get the commentary and kind of get a better sense of that. But it's just crazy that you know, you think of her from the Rock Hudson comedies and things like that, and then see this side of her is really kind of disarming. So appreciate that aspect of the movie a lot.
Yeah, I would go so far as to say that. And I had actually watched a few Doris Day movies recently because I was actually doing some prep for a new Bev episode for Pure Cinema because they're showing some Doris Days. And I like that stuff a lot, but it almost put me in the worst frame of mind to watch this movie because she really gets put through the ringer on this movie. And like you said, it's a very naked performance and it's so raw in parts. Like, it looks like she's almost having a nervous breakdown. And it became almost uncomfortable for me to watch where I was at with her. And it, you know, it's a great performance on that level, but I was just like, oh man, this is kind of brutal. I feel kind of bad for her. So it was a little rough, I gotta say.
Yeah, I agree entirely. It's very uncomfortable to watch, and especially because of the dryness of the rest of the cast, everyone else is so casual in their kind of meanness and their nastiness towards her. It's very, you know, they're all very British about it. So the characters like Roddy McDowell and Myrna Loy.
Oh, Myrna Loy, that's right. That's a great addition to this cast. Her visiting older aunt comes to see her, and, you know, you kind of hope that she's going to be on Doris Day's side, but it's a tricky spot because there's just nobody there to corroborate what's going on, and so it just becomes more and more difficult. But
Very upsetting. I mean, it gets to a point where you're thinking she's completely delusional and she's losing her mind, or everybody in this movie is gaslighting her.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
And that's upsetting. That's really upsetting,
especially with Doris Day. It really is. But moving on real quick to the commentary, Kat Ellinger, I mean, she's a superstar and she's always great. I'm sure you feel the same way.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah,
she's one of my favorite people to read or to hear talk about movies.
I do love the, like I said, the stable of people that Kino has rounded up, you know, between the guys I mentioned on the Silent Partner disc and then Tim Lucas and then Kat and Sam Deegan. Like, they're really getting some great folks as a regular recurring stable. Jim Hemphill, I think, is showing up on their stuff now, too. So she's great. And she just, like I said, she gives a great context for the movie and for all the actors and talks about the film in terms of what it meant for Doris Day. She talks about being an update of the woman's film at the time. Anything else you gleaned from that before we move on to the next disc?
That was the main thing I was curious about, was, you know, how this was sort of a transition between the women's films of the 30s and 40s and then moving into stuff in the 60s and 70s. And especially since Kat was on the commentary with Sam Deegan to do Images, the era release of Robert Altman's Images, which is what I feel like this movie sort of evolved into eventually. Speaking of Susanna York, I was curious to hear her take on it. I was definitely interested to hear her thoughts on David Miller, the director. I'm not familiar with the other women's tortured films that he did, like Sudden Fear and Twist of Fate and Story of Esther Costello. So it was great to hear her talk about some of those and get a context with that.
Good stuff, yeah. It's a great disc overall and a movie that's been overlooked in Doris Day's filmography, so definitely worth a pickup, I think. Moving on to another sort of thriller. This is Link from 1986. This is directed by the great and late Richard Franklin. And it is a kind of an animal attack movie at the end of the day.
I call it half animal attack movie, half chamber piece.
Yes, that's perfect. That's absolutely perfect.
For centuries, the link between man and the primates has been shrouded in darkness. Surrounded by mystery.
Dr. Phillip is expecting me.
Now, one man has closed the gap.
Well, he's a different kind of intelligence.
Forged the link.
It's different, all right.
And discovered what has always been missing.
Don't get involved in their squabbles. They sort them out.
In here.
Always forgive them, whatever they do. Don't ever let anything escalate.
Are you right?
You killed Dennis.
Link, I said stop! Push it! Open the door now! You gotta think him.
How?
Man is no longer in control.
the setup is that Elizabeth Shue plays a young college student, I believe, who I think she has a class with Terrence Stamp, who plays a professor scientist type who's doing work with primates. And she wants to do something for him, but he ends up hiring her to come help out at his house, which is a little creepy, but she does it nonetheless.
That should slow you down a bit.
There you go.
Little monster's been getting out at night. He likes cats.
Why don't you get him one?
He likes to eat them. Don't you?
Well, Doctor, if you're not looking for an assistant, I won't take up any more of your time. I'm sorry.
You attended more than one of my lectures?
Yes, my boyfriend's in the class.
Ah.
And I've read Back to the Trees, and I was interested to hear you in person.
Do you, cook, clean, stuff like that?
Well, I'm female. I guess that gives me a genetic aptitude.
I have a house up the coast. I could use a sort of, assistant during the holidays. Can't pay much, though.
That's fine. As I said, I would really just like the chance to work with you, and I need to save some money.
Well, let's say, accommodation and board and, £40 a week.
That's great.
Huh. Well, see my secretary tomorrow and, fix up the details, so. I'll see you in a few weeks, then.
Okay. Bye.
And, he has... And it's an orangutan in his house?
It's supposed to be a chimpanzee.
Oh, okay.
But it's played by an orangutan named Locke.
Yes.
And they painted his fur black so he would look more like a chimpanzee. Don't ask me why he couldn't just be an orangutan, but that's what they decided to do.
Yeah. So the story, without giving too much away, is that she comes to stay at his house. She's sort of helping him out. She's getting to know the orangutan chimp. He actually has two, right? He has a smaller one and then this bigger one.
And a female as well, three. In
total. Oh, there's three. That's right. I forgot.
Yeah.
And eventually there is a bit of an uprising and things get a little crazy with the animals and she's in a bad spot. I don't want to give away too much. I just know that if you haven't seen this movie, again, directed by Richard Franklin, who is one hell of a class act and a guy that I love. I adore Cloak and Dagger. I love Psycho 2. Road Games is a masterpiece. I mean, he is just one of those incredible disciples of Hitchcock who, like De Palma, but much less known, really was a master craftsman and took the lessons that Hitchcock taught to heart and really makes great thrillers. And this is a good one. I'm a big fan. So I don't know.
This is a movie, longtime favorite.
Nice.
I love Link. I've discussed it in depth with Wendy Mays over on her excellent podcast, Pet Cemetery,
which is about I gotta go back
animal
movies
specifically. Yeah, that's a fantastic show.
Definitely people listen to Pet Cemetery if you haven't. It's great.
It is terrific. Yeah, so that was fun. I just love revisiting this movie. I could watch it 1,000 times. I specifically, you know, got into Richard Franklin the way everybody does by watching Patrick and Road Games and everything and thinking, wow, this guy, why is he not being, you know, considered among the ranks of the great filmmakers of the 70s and 80s the way so many of his contemporaries are. And then Link, I think, is the beginning of his career where people stopped taking him seriously.
Yeah.
You know, they thought he might be, you know, kind of devolving into doing sequels like FX2 and things like that and making killer monkey movies.
I love FX2, by the way.
I love FX2. I think it's terrific. I like it better than FX.
I might be inclined to agree, but I love them both.
They're both good, but FX2 is a fun movie. I really enjoy it. But Link, I think, is also phenomenal, and for people who think, you know, he moved past his Hitchcock influences by this time, it's so Hitchcocky. There are so many specific Hitchcock ideas, mainly Psycho, mainly like this playing with the audience expectations and character perspectives within this house where it's set. Most of the film is set at the seaside manor that they're in. There is a lot of cool tricks within this film, in this narrative, and a lot of weird surprises. So on top of it being, I used to call it the greatest Killer Monkey Butler movie ever made.
That is a good way to summarize.
I thought so, but then talking to Winnie Mays, she said, well, is he a butler? And it got me thinking that, wow, maybe he's not. Because we're introduced to him opening the door for Elizabeth Shue,
yeah.
showing her her room, taking her bags, you know. And he's wearing this butler outfit yeah. throughout the movie. But that's really all we see. And then Terrence Stamp doesn't really treat him like a butler. So True. He's definitely a primate. Is he a butler? I don't know. We can't make that official.
Regardless, it's a good thriller, and he ramps it up well, and he does his usual great job, and that's not meant to be flippant about his work. It's actually meant to let you know that if you know his work, this movie doesn't disappoint. I agree. What did you think of the commentary? There's actually a commentary. Actually, you know what? Let's start with the audio interview with Franklin himself. What did you think of that?
I enjoyed it. It's very brief. It's yeah. very short, little clip from an interview. I get the feeling he maybe didn't want to talk about this movie a lot, although I thought I had a memory of listening to an audio commentary on the old Anchor Bay DVD of him. I guess that must be wrong. I couldn't find evidence of it anywhere online, so I might just be crazy.
Oh.
I thought I had at one point listened to... I might be thinking about Patrick, but...
Oh.
At any rate, they did not port anything over to this in terms of a commentary from Franklin, unfortunately. So maybe he doesn't talk about the movie a lot. That's why they only have this very brief audio clip of him discussing the film.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer. But I should also mention, though, that... On top of this being a great movie from Franklin, it's a great screenplay by Everett DeRoche, the great Australian screenwriter.
Good call.
Who is like Mr. Animal Attack movie, just when you think about films like Long Weekend.
Great
and,
movie.
And Razorback, you know, some really terrific Australian films with animals attacking. And also how he makes the dingo in Road Games such a great character in that film. You know, he really... is on screen as much as Stacy Keach is, and he becomes such a central part of the plot. So the guy can write animals.
Yeah.
You got to give right. that to him.
You're totally yeah. right. That's such a great putting together of some stuff that I hadn't exactly done. I mean, I knew the movies, but I'd forgotten about the dingo, and that's a great callback. Yeah, he's a great writer, and he really is responsible for some of the great Australian films of all time, really. So yeah, it's great to have him here. Yeah, I thought the interview was okay. You're right. It's short, and he mostly, it may speak to like what you're saying in that he touches on the difficulties of filming the movie. And, you know, it sounds like a very tricky shoot. And I think, you know, it makes sense that a director who had a tricky shoot followed by probably not the warmest reception critically and just in terms of his career overall, you know, it may be the sort of bastard child for him, unfortunately. But I do agree with you. It's a well-made film, and that's too bad. I enjoyed the what I heard of the Lee Gambin, Jarrett Grand commentary. They touched on a lot of things. They made some connections I thought were interesting, like popularity of animal and apes movies around this time. They cited Phenomenon and Monkey Shines and a few more. Mm-hmm. They talked about Elizabeth Shue and this being her very next film after The Karate Kid, which I'd never put together for some reason, and how there's kind of a love triangle angle and link that is slightly similar to The Karate Kid, which I thought was humorous.
Yeah, that's a fun commentary. I mean, both these guys are very chatty and excited Australians, so it's yeah. it's hard to tell who's talking throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
But they're both big fans of the movie, obviously, and Lee Gambin is another guy who obviously knows his animal movies.
Yes.
He just wrote a whole book about the making of Cujo, which is terrific. He's doing a commentary on the new Eureka limited edition Blu-ray of Cujo.
Excellent.
So he knows what he's talking about for sure. And he gets into some fun stuff. He name drops all the right monkey movies, Shockma in the Shadow of Kilimanjaro.
Oh, nice. That needs a Blu-ray.
Yeah, some great ones. The Japanese Planet of the Apes ripoff Time of the Apes.
Oh, wow. Which I'd
love to see that on Blu at some point.
That may happen I mean, I guess I don't know who owns it, but it seems like Shout Factory has taken to releasing a lot of the movies that Mystery Science Theater has covered. I guess a lot of them are studio films, but they're including the Mystery Science Theater version. And I know Mystery Science Theater covered Time of the Apes at one point, and I don't know if that could potentially line up in any way. Probably not.
I did not know that.
They did, yeah. It's a fun episode, by the way. But yeah, In the Shadow of Kilimanjaro is a movie that really needs a Blu-ray. I think, is it In the Shadow? Did I say that right?
In the Shadow, yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's really good. Really good movie. And I don't even know, maybe it has a DVD, but I've only ever seen it on VHS so far.
I think I have a bootleg of it. I don't even know if it ever got a DVD release.
Nice. But anyway, Link, also highly recommended. I'm going to go out over and check out your Pet Cemetery episode for a deeper dive into this movie. I'd love to hear that. I totally missed you had done that. So very cool.
It's a fun movie to dive into. One interesting thing is that I always thought Terrence Stamp was creepier than he actually is in the finished film.
Mm.
It turns out it was a good instinct on my part because all the cutscenes included on this Blu-ray, the deleted scenes, are of him being creepier. It's like him like visiting her in her room to give her a signed book that says, if you ever need an old book, meet me in my room or something.
Yikes.
Like that, you know?
Yikes.
And it explains the scene where she opens the door and there's this like a lit cigar in front of her door and it really throws her off. Because he was standing outside her door with smoking a cigar, we find out in the deleted scene. So
creepy.
Explains a few things, makes him creepier.
Nice.
So for people who come specifically for the smarm of Terrence Stamp, go to the deleted scenes and you'll get even more than you hoped for.
Excellent. Excellent. All right, now moving on to something completely different. We have Bend of the River from 1952.
Starring James Stewart as Glenn McClintock, Indian fighter, trailblazer, a tower of strength in the wilderness.
Come on, keep rolling! Yes, sir!
Arthur Kennedy, whose smile hid the desperation of a hunted man. Julia Adams, who made the mistake of loving two men. Rock Hudson, who gambled with cards and with lives.
You're fired.
Anything you paid for that food will give you 10 times what it cost if you bring it to the digging.
Hey, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Any man can make a mistake. He can make lots of mistakes. But when he meets a woman and falls in love with her...
I see what you mean.
This is a Anthony Mann Western, one of many, I believe, 8. I could be misnumbering the amount of Westerns that he did with Anthony Mann. But this is a really good one, and one that I had forgotten. I had sort of marginalized it for some reason. I had put it off to the side as one that was like, okay. But I was really impressed with this. It really hooked me in a bigger way than I remembered. It stars, obviously, Jimmy Stewart and then Arthur Kennedy. Julie Adams, under the name Julia Adams, pre-Creature from the Black Lagoon, and Rock Hudson, among others. J.C. Flippin, Stephen Fetchett, Henry Morgan. It's a really good cast, nice deep bench. But it's a really cool, it's got almost like a sense of Bud Baedeker in terms of the introduction of the characters. Like, Jimmy Stewart is like a quasi-mysterious man who's helping a wagon train find their way, and he stumbles upon a near hanging where Arthur Kennedy's character is about to be hanged for supposedly stealing a horse. And for whatever reason, Jimmy Stewart decides to involve himself and he shoots him down, and they both scare off the hanging party. And then Arthur Kennedy joins up briefly with, well, not briefly, no, he joins up with the wagon train and Jimmy, and they have a really great exchange when they meet each other, where they're very cagey and sort of asking each other questions about their histories. And we get a sense right then of Jimmy's got some kind of checkered past, and so does Arthur Kennedy.
About this horse, I really didn't steal him, if that makes any difference.
It doesn't.
That's what I thought. Why did you step in?
Well, I just don't like hanging.
It's a funny thing, I don't either. You're riding south?
No, I'm going north. Picking some folks up in the Columbia River country. Farmers. Real nice folks.
Yeah, settlers, huh? Is that your trade, a guy?
No, not exactly. No, I've been doing a lot of things. I ran into these folks in Missouri. I thought maybe I might try my hand at farming or ranching if I can find me some cattle. They make good biscuits, these folks. You're going to like them.
I didn't catch your name. Or did you say it?
McClintock. Glenn McClintock.
Glenn McClintock. From the Missouri country?
That's right.
You're going to go farming?
Or ranching. If I can get me some cattle. Come on, let's get those biscuits.
And then it just becomes sort of an interesting you know, build of like what's going to happen with this wagon train group and, you know, who are the bad guys, basically, along with some sort of danger along the way. But boy, I am such a huge fan of Arthur Kennedy, and it's something that's sort of crept up on me over the past 7-8 years. I think it started when I saw Rancho Notorious for the first time, and I was like, holy shit. He's good. He's really so good. I think the other thing is I'd looped him in with Van Heflin, and I actually really like Van Heflin, but I think I like Arthur Kennedy more. And so, because I have seen a few bland Van Heflin roles, I've also seen a ton of great Van Heflin roles. But I think sometimes I'll have that where a certain actor suddenly becomes intertwined with another actor because they resemble them, or they were in movies around the same time, they were contemporaries. And for some reason, Arthur Kennedy got looped in, and I had written him off a little bit. But boy, he and Jimmy Stewart in this movie have such a great rapport. I don't know. What did you think of this one?
Yeah, they both have the kind of that strong chin, Van Heflin and Kennedy,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's an interesting comparison. Well, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said Boddicker. And like Boddicker, I would never begrudge somebody their favorite of the Bud Boddicker, Randolph Scott movies, or which one was the best. You know,
yeah.
I think they're all so great. I wouldn't argue against any of them. Same thing goes with the Anthony Mann, Jimmy Stewart westerns that they did. 5 within 6 years of each other, I think.
Yeah.
Really short amount of time, because they're all great, and I say that because this is my favorite.
Oh, nice.
Personally. I won't cry out the word masterpiece, quite frankly, when I come to this film. It's so tight. It's so concise in its ideas. It's so beautiful in its execution. It's just a nice, swift, 90-minute movie filled with action, filled with lots of drama. It's just an amazing film that really gets into its characters and examines, I think, something that the best Western movies examine, which is that you have to rely on people, you know, in this wilderness when you're trying to settle a new life, when you're trying to get a town started, when you're just trying to start a fire sometimes, you have to rely on the people around you. And that's a really difficult thing to do because people are out for their own interest. People are trying to see opportunities for themselves, and people are just flat out not willing to help you. Jimmy Stewart's character, Glenn McClintock, decides that he is going to be the guy who offers to help people. He's going to, whatever his past was, he is now going to step up and help this new settlement get going. And that is going to be his redemption. For him, that's all it is. For Arthur Kennedy's Emerson Cole, that's not all there is. Cole will go along with McClintock to a certain point, and that's another kind of interesting thing that Mann examines in this film, was like, what level is the corruption going to take hold? You know, he'll help him get out of Portland when everyone's after him. He'll help him get away from these guys that they've hired to help them out, who decide to, you know, take over the food shipment that they're moving up the mountains. But he, at one point, you know, he's going to turn on him, and it's just inevitable.
He couldn't take it, huh? If I don't go, you'll go. If you hurry, you'll make it before it snows. You know, Red was right. You should have used the gun.
I figure we're even. Maybe I'm one up on you. I'll be seeing you, Glenn.
You'll be seeing me. You'll be seeing me. Every time you bed down for the night, you'll look back into the darkness and wonder if I'm there. And some night I will be. You'll be seeing me.
So the morality of this film is so amazing that Stewart just wants that thank you, that that's good enough for him, for them to say, thank you for helping us, is all he needs, even though Kennedy tries to tell him. And again, there's, like you said, this great rapport between them. He tries to convince them, these are people with a moral high ground that they will just toss you to the side if they think you don't rise up to it. They will completely forget about you. They will turn on you at the drop of a hat, and yet you want to help them out. And Stewart says, yeah, that's all I want. All I want is to help these people, and for them to say thank you is all I need. So with that on the line, on this, you know, movement to try to get this food to these people, the tension is just so thick, you know, it's just from one scene to another, it's just mounting tension until it's all going to break. So it's just so much fun to, like, go with these characters and visit these themes with Mann, and I could watch this movie over and over again.
Yeah, no, well said. And I, you know what I forgot to do is I forgot to set up the fact that the wagon train gets to a settlement, which is a ways north of What's the big city they're trying, or the town they come back to?
Portland is the Portland. The big city.
Yeah. Yeah, so they get to their settlement. They've brought along enough food for a short while, but then they've also made agreements with a guy who's very friendly at the beginning of the movie that's going to have further supplies that will help them get through the winter available that he will send up in a couple months. And what happens is the supplies don't show up. And I won't go too far into what's happened, but that's Jimmy has to go back to the town and go, hey, what's going on? And all the while knowing that if he doesn't get this, like you said, get this food back to the settlement, all these people are going to die, basically. And so that's what's on the line then, too, is sort of the lives of these people and the tension of the characters involved, not only Arthur Kennedy, but some other people that I won't get into. But yeah, it's such a great tension, and it's so well done, and it ramps up to a really great end. And yeah, I really, really liked it a lot. I totally can see how you could put it at the top of the stack. It's close for me. I really like Man from Laramie a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So
oh, yeah.
That might edge it out, but not by much. And it is interesting that for whatever reason, the Baedeker thing just came to me right now. I'm sure you had thought about it already, but for some reason, it just, I didn't even have it in my notes, and I was just suddenly like, Baedeker, that's what this is like. And mm-hmm. Why didn't I ever think this parallel tracks happening between Anthony Mann and Jimmy Stewart and Baedeker and Randolph Scott, like doing these groups of Westerns together, all great, all stripped down. I mean, it's just two wonderful movements in cinema history as far as Westerns go. And I feel like if you have not absorbed all of both sides of this stream, if you will, you need to. You got to watch all the Baedekers. You got to watch all these Anthony Mann, Jimmy Stewart Westerns because they're great.
You got to do it. Yeah.
This is such a good example. And I'm so glad that this came out. And I hope that we get to see some more from Kino because they've broken in. And I mentioned this before on the show, but they've broken into the Universal Vault. And I think all the Mann Westerns, I'm pretty sure all the Mann Westerns are Universal films. I could be wrong about that. There may be some Fox in there, but I think they're mostly Universal. So hopefully we'll get more of these. There is a commentary by Toby Rohn, which I liked, but another one that I didn't have too much that I took notes on. I did say this is the second of 8 Westerns that Stewart did with Anthony Mann. This is just post Winchester 73, which is also great. And he goes into the difficulties of this shoot and how tough it was to move the cast, crew, cattle, wagons, etc. And there's also plenty of background in the actors. Was there any other anecdotes you pulled out of this one?
You know, I've got to be completely honest. No offense at all to Toby Rohn. I this is just one of those movies. I didn't realize this was a thing. I don't want to hear anyone talking over it. You know,
that's pretty cool.
I don't want to hear a commentary. I don't know. It's a movie that I need to see it.
I can
I need to hear
it.
I need it all, and I can't be distracted by any. I'm sure there is a ton of interesting anecdotes and, you know, history behind the making of this film. Maybe one day I'll listen to it without the image on or something like that. But I'll hold off on the commentary.
That's totally
for
cool,
now.
Man. I get it. Yeah. And I understand. And that makes sense. But it is a great disc with that or without it. Really looked nice. And it's wonderful. I really appreciate your high praise on it because that'll definitely help sell some people on this one. Great, great movie.
It looks beautiful. But like you said, all the Anthony Mann Westerns are absolutely worth seeing. Winchester 73, Naked Spur, Man from Laramie, Far Country, they're all terrific.
Oh, and, Naked Spur. Naked Spur is a Warner Brothers movie, so that's definitely not, that would have to be a Warner Archive Blu-ray. And I feel like that could happen. I feel like that could very reasonably happen. I don't have any insights, but that seems like something they would pull out of the catalog at some point. So I hope that, you know, it's crazy to me that we got all the Baedeker Westerns on Blu-ray before we got all the Jimmy Stewart, Anthony Mann Westerns, but I think that will be remedied within the next 2 years. That's just my prediction.
I hope so. That would be really great.
So moving on to our second to last movie in the pile here. This was one you recommended and I had never seen. It is The Man Who Haunted Himself from 1970.
Listen, just tell me the name.
What name? What are you talking about?
Is it blackmail?
Get out of here!
Listen, you're mad! Listen! I have a wife and 2 kids and I want to know what's behind all this.
First of all, there is the possibility, though ever unlikely, that there is an actual double dogging your footsteps.
Could there be another explanation?
There could.
Is all this true? All these times I've been coming here.
You don't remember?
None of it.
If you want other women, you can have them.
Eve, I don't want other women.
Well, you certainly don't want me.
How many times do I have to tell you I've never seen her?
This is directed by Basil Dearden and stars James Bond himself, Roger Moore, just pre-James Bond. And it is a very interesting psychological thriller that plays very much like a Twilight Zone kind of episode in a very good way. Now, had you seen this one before, or was this a blind watch?
This is blind for me. I've just started watching a bunch of the non-Bond Roger Moore movies that I hadn't seen before.
Cool.
So I was excited. So I convinced you to do this one so I could have an excuse to pick it up.
That's great.
I'm glad you did. I really liked it. I think, you know, it's got a reputation of being his best performance outside of the Bond films. A lot of people say the movie where he actually gets to act, you know, he's not just looking suave and cool. And he definitely, much like Doris Day in Midnight Lace, he really gets to kind of go past the the borders of sanity in this movie and really have scenes where he's breaking down and losing his shit that are fun to watch. And he's obviously a really, really dynamic actor. So I appreciated that about it. Like in this big freakout scene, he says he feels like he's drowning. And not to give anything away, but that's a nice foreshadow to what's going to happen ultimately in this movie.
Do we want to like give the basic setup? I'm trying to.
You kind of have to, right?
Yeah. I mean, okay. So it's sort of a doppelganger movie, if we're being honest. And it's a thing where he gets in an accident. His character gets in an accident at the beginning of the film, and he almost dies. And there is a momentary like double heartbeat on the EKG, and then it goes away.
It's a really cool effect.
A great effect. I like that a lot. And then, you know, it's a sort of a creeping paranoia of, you know, people starting to tell him they've seen him around places he wasn't at or during a time when he was hospitalized or something, and he's just like, well, they must have been mistaken. And then you start to get a sense of, oh, maybe something really is happening, and he gets more and more worked up and paranoid and upset, and like you say, I didn't even think to compare it to the Doris Day, but it totally is that kind of thing. And it is a really solid performance from him. He's really given a good amount to do, and he goes a ways with it. So, yeah, I dug this. Basil Dearden is a director I didn't... I knew he had done part of Dead of Night. The movie Victim is a big one. I remember Criterion put that on Laserdisc. That's a good one. And then All Night Long and League of Gentlemen. I haven't seen those yet, but I've been meaning to see those. Are you a Basil Dearden fan?
He's super prolific, so I've definitely seen a bunch of his movies. I think he's one of those journeyman directors, though, who I've never really, like, you know, cornered his exact style.
Me neither.
Recognized his, you know, oh yeah, he did this and this and this. You know,
I would
be surprised if you told me he made such and such and what have you. So,
yeah.
Not as familiar with him as I'd like to be, but this is a good one.
Yeah, no, definitely a good one. And it's got a nice ambiguous sort of last shot ending that I liked, or maybe not. I read it as possibly ambiguous, but I thought that was fun. And I do think it's interesting that this is Roger Moore post The Saint, again, pre-James Bond, in this very interesting spot between those two career tent poles. And those kind of anomalies sometimes are little pockets for an actor to do some really interesting work. And I think this is definitely an example of that. There is a commentary that I believe is ported over from a DVD because Roger Moore has passed away. It's him and the producer, Brian Forbes, moderated by Jonathan Sothcott. And they talk about many things, Forbes's productions, but the thing I remember is more talking about the actors loving to have something to hide behind, like a mustache or a makeup or what have you. And he told a story about Laurence Olivier on Sleuth asking Joseph L. Mankiewicz if he could have a fake nose, and he fightingly got him to agree to a mustache. And just how something as simple as that is just the amount of shielding that an actor needs to protect themselves or to get into character. And I just thought that's really interesting. I wouldn't have thought that would have been such a big deal, but if you're a pro like that, giving yourself just one little thing can really set things up. And I thought that was neat.
Yeah, definitely. It's because he does eventually play two characters in this movie. So
yeah.
On top of having the mustache and, you know, kind of having that to kind of hide behind, he has to create two completely different personalities in this film. It reminded me a lot of the Harlan Ellison story, Shatterday. Do you know that one?
I've heard of it, but I don't think I've read it.
That's one where a guy accidentally calls his own apartment and he picks up.
Oh, nice.
His doppelganger is already there. And so it becomes this sort of cat and mouse game between them where, you know, they're trying to get the upper hand and win the life, you know, be the one who comes out at the end and still get to survive and be part of that life.
Cool.
Which got adapted into, speaking of Twilight Zone, in the 80s Twilight Zone, Wes Craven directed an adaptation of it with Bruce Willis.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yeah. And this apparently was originally an Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode, or rather they adapted the same short story that this movie adapted. So definitely your Twilight Zone comparison, I think, is another sad loss recently was Freddie Jones, who was fantastic in this movie, playing kind of a weird psychiatrist that Roger Moore ends up going to see when he's still not sure if he's just imagining all this stuff. There's a really cool shot of Moore sitting in a chair and Freddie Jones kind of rotating around him in this shot where the camera stays still, but they're rotating around it, and it's a really cool. And he has like a neat pair of sunglasses and sideburns and a vest. So soon after losing Freddie Jones, it was nice to see him in this movie.
Nice. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, good stuff. No, this was a good watch and definitely another one that I think fans of Roger Moore should definitely check out, because it is among my favorite performances that I've seen from him, for sure.
Yeah, Kino has been really cool about bringing out some of the non-Bond Roger Moore movies. Coming out just later this year is my very favorite Roger Moore movie, Folks.
AKA North Sea Hijack?
Yeah. Huh?
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to that because I think I've seen it, but honestly, it's one of those where I got it on DVD because a friend recommended it, and then I think I started it and I got interrupted. Something happened. And then I didn't come back to it for whatever reason, and it may be a case of like I moved and then I lost my DVD and then I just never got around to it again. And then I saw that announcement. I was like, yes, I don't remember this movie. This will be like a first time watch for me. I've heard nothing but good things about it. So that's your favorite. That's great.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, it's a huge favorite. And moving even further away from the Bond, he's got a whole beard in this one, not just the mustache.
Nice, so nice.
He's definitely going in the opposite direction. Yeah. But also Street People with Moore and Stacey Keach is coming out later in November from Kino.
Oh, cool.
So they're really carting out the Moors. So that's fun.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. So that is The Man Who Haunted Himself. And then our last disc.
Ooh, but real quick, we should mention the two gentlemen who show up on this disc we're big fans of.
Oh, Joe Dante and Stuart Gordon.
Yes.
Masters of Horror. Yes, that's good stuff. I forgot. That's a little extra that they have there.
It's cool seeing them talk about the movie. It was great seeing Stuart with his copy of Truffaut's Book on Hitchcock in front of him in the desk.
Yes.
He read up on it. He's all set to go. And he made an interesting connection that I had thought of watching the movie, which was Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You know?
Oh, yeah.
The sense that, you know, someone's trying to take over your life. That sense of paranoia running throughout.
So yeah, that's perfect.
Something that I had thought about, too.
Yeah, that's a great sell. I mean, if you're into that kind of paranoia film, this is exactly that on a much smaller scale, and it's great. Yeah.
Yeah, so people who need the further endorsement to see this movie, if you're a fan of Joe Dante and Stuart Gordon, they're fans of this one.
Good call. Yeah, I shouldn't have left that off. That's great. So last but definitely not least is Peter Yates' film Robbery from 1967.
Do we provide the shooters?
No guns.
What happens if things get sticky?
Turn on the charm, Ben.
Now, look, no guns. I want no violence, no accidents. They don't carry guns. We don't need them.
$5 million and no guns.
They don't carry guns. And they've never been done.
I still think we should have them.
Why, in case someone should disturb your hair?
I can handle myself. I just don't reckon getting caught.
Nobody does. If you're caught with a shooter, it's three times the sentence.
Okay. No guns. Now, about the sheriff.
What about the sheriff?
I don't like the idea of the money leaving the country before the payout. I want mine before we split up.
We're talking about millions of pounds now. We're talking about roadblocks, car searches, house raids, shakedowns. They'll know who pulled the job. Without the money, they can't prove anything.
You said the notes won't be traceable.
You'll get the money. When it's safe.
Okay, that's it then. My boys are out.
And mine.
We can't do it on our own.
No.
We'll have to postpone it then.
Yes.
All right. Now, you said you have a lot to say about this one, so I'm going to let you have at it. I mean, except for the fact that I'll just set it up as based on a sort of true events about a really big robbery of a train, which I think is interesting, and a movie that opens with a really great car chase that, of course, sets up Peter Yates to do one of the greatest car chases of all time in Bullitt the very next year and continue.
Yeah, it got him the job.
Yeah, I didn't. So McQueen saw this movie. Is that what happened?
Yeah. Apparently that's what happened. Yeah, I didn't know that, but yeah, saw the opening chase and was like, "This is our guy."
Yeah, and that chase has some really good moments that I don't feel like I've seen in another movie. And one of them is where they're driving along and the driver starts telling some of the other people in the car to jump out as they're going. And I'm like, why haven't I seen more car chases that do that and basically get everyone else out of the car except the driver?
Yeah.
It's such a good idea. And there's a great moment with a children's school that I won't spoil that's also pretty intense. But so now this movie was a first-time watch for you on this disc?
Yeah. First thing, I got to say thank you, man. This is one that you came up with for this episode when we were trying to think of one or two extra films we could throw on the pile. This is the one that you threw out there, and I probably would have completely missed it otherwise. And I loved it, so I'm really glad that you threw this one in there.
Nice. Yeah, I hadn't seen it either, honestly. It's one I'd purchased an import Blu-ray from, I can't remember the British company, because it was Yates and because I'd heard, I don't know if I'd heard the Steve McQueen story, but I'd heard that it was something that led to, you know, bigger things for him, but I had never seen it. So this was a first time watch and I was really psyched to get to check it out. But go into your, what are the things you like about it? What are some things you enjoyed?
Okay, well, first I'll just say as a preamble to Peter Yates, right? We all know that he is very hard to get to categorize as a filmmaker, because he was such a successful journeyman going from, you know, The Friends of Eddie Coyle to Breaking Away. You know, he couldn't get two more different films within a few years of each other. And then, forget it, he goes to Kroll and just everyone threw their arms up, you know.
Well, and the one that I haven't seen but I've heard is great is The Dresser. It's supposed to be really good. And
Right.
You know, and that's a totally different vibe from a lot of this stuff, you know.
Right, and to go from The Deep to The Dresser is like, this is by the same guy? Like, who would know?
And then the Hot Rock, which is a little bit like this, but definitely more of a fun caper comedy, you know. And then Eyewitness, which is also great, but more of a thriller. I mean, he's got a really deep, awesome filmography. I love him.
And let me just say, too, that after you and Rob G talked about Kroll recently on an episode, and you played a clip from him shooting that movie where he says, "Action, lasers." I've had that in my head ever since. And I just wish I was making movies right now so I could just say, "Action, lasers."
Oh, man, I'm so glad you caught that, man. That's so funny.
It's so much fun. This is just a really fun, really stripped down heist movie where the characters are just basically there to do their jobs. You know, you learn a little bit about their background, about their personal lives, but really it's a very business-like arrangement. It's I guess a blue-collar heist movie, you would say, where these characters all know their job. They're all very amiable. There's not like a Marie Windsor character to screw everything up. You know, there's no like backstabbing. Yeah. It's not noirish in any way, I would say. It's very like everyone's just there to do their job, and they, like, you know, they have it all timed out and they have it all figured. You know, it's you go get this vehicle and I'm going to go and arrange things with that guy. And so it just becomes this very entertaining, you know, story of these guys getting together and planning this heist. It has really cool elements like the chasing at the beginning is a heist that's going to fund the big heist. You know, you get to see this little mini heist before they come together to do the big one. And that and just starting with that chase scene, I got to say that first 10-15 minutes of the movie is just, what a way to start a film. I'm going to go on a limb here and say I like it better than the Bullitt chase scene.
Whoa.
I think it's freaking great. Turning all those corners around London, that one continuous shot where they come so close to clipping the cop and he throws something and breaks the windshield, and then they have to punch out the windshield.
Yeah.
Like, it's intense. It is a great, great opening.
It's not underselling it to say you'll understand why he gets bullet after you see it, because you'll be like, oh, wow, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Of course,
he understands what he's doing. And it is really interesting to me because, I don't know his films prior to this, so I don't know how much action he had done before this movie, but man, oh man, he comes out of the gate real strong. Even if this is his second action movie or third, it's still one of the most assured, well-handled car chases that I've ever seen. And no surprise that, you know, he goes on to do one that people, you know, laud him for. But yeah, I could see you making a case for it being better. I mean, I love the bullet chase and it's so iconic. And, you know, the car basically fucking falls apart at the end of that chase. And there's something really great about that. Not Steve's, but the other guy's car.
Yeah,
I've always loved that about it. Just driving a car to literally the point of disintegration is pretty great. And this movie doesn't exactly have that, but it is one of the best openings to an older film that I've seen in a while. And, you know, openings are a big deal. Like for me at this point, when I'm watching movies, I do like a movie to open strong. And even though that can set a movie sort of back on its heels in terms of like maintaining, but I do feel like this one does a decent job of maintaining once it starts with that incredible chase. I mean, it doesn't top the chase, I don't think necessarily, but I think it maintains. And I think that's something that movies that I get a little bit disappointed with, and I'm not making broad generalizations here, but just in terms of like, they'll come out of the gate okay, and then maybe start to ramp up, and then I'm like, okay, yeah, no, it's all right. But coming out strong and then maintaining is very difficult, I think, to do, and he really pulls it off.
Oh, I agree. And not only that, but going through this opening chase with these four or five guys who are the main guys behind the heist, it just kind of puts you in with them, right? You know, you've seen them get away from the cops at this point and go through this really intense chase scene. So you're kind of with them in a weird way. You know, you kind of want to follow them along and hope that they get away with it and hope that they don't get caught. Just kind of gives you like a nice opening to appreciate the characters and kind of stick with them, because it's going to be another, you know, hour and a half where they're, you know, putting this caper together. And like you said, there's not going to be another big chase scene or anything like that, but it's going to be this very detailed and very involved operation that they're handling, and you just have to be with them. And so you're just kind of with them from that moment on after they get away from the cops in this chase scene.
Yeah, I think it helps that Stanley Baker is the headliner of the movie, and he's one of the great British character actors of all time, in my opinion. I'm sure that's not a widely unheld opinion. I'm sure a lot of people agree with that. But he's a great blue-collar everyman, and he is affable without being comedic. He's just a great grounded dude that you just somehow you want to root for. He's I don't know what it is about him. He's just got a quality about him, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the whole cast here is actually terrific.
You're right.
Baker's great. It's half the cast of Zulu, basically.
That's right.
Stanley Baker and James Booth, who I should mention is in another personal favorite of mine, the Michael Dudikoff movie Avenging Force, which I bring up because it's available from Kino for less than $10.
Very nice. I love it.
Unrecognizable Frank Finlay playing the kind of nebbish guy that they break out of prison with the glasses.
Oh, God, yeah.
He's been in so many great movies like the Lester Musketeer films, and I didn't recognize him in this movie because he looks so different. Barry Foster from Twisted Nerve and The Wild Geese. Just a great set of British actors in this movie. So there's one thing I have against the movie. It's that it doesn't care as much about the procedural side. Maybe I'm just spoiled by like late Melville movies, but like I kind of like to know how the cops tighten the noose, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it just wasn't. I just think this movie's not interested in that. That's which is fine, you know. That's just me.
Yeah.
They want to focus on the heist, and that's totally fine. One thing that I wish that they had included on this disc. I don't know if this footage actually exists, but apparently they had decided to hire Jason Robards to do a scene at the end of the movie because they wanted one American actor in the movie. And then they ultimately decided, no, it doesn't work, so they just cut it out, even though they had hired Robards and shot the scene and everything. So
that could have
been interesting. I was curious to see what that would have played like.
Yeah,
but,
that would have been a nice little button on the end. I can get how it could take you out to just bring him in at the end, but nowadays I feel like it'd just be a great character actor moment to have at the end. It wouldn't be so terrible, but that's pretty cool. I did not realize that. What did you think of the Nick Pinkerton commentary? You and I exchanged a little Twitter nod about it, but I wanted to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, Pinkerton is he's fun, man.
I like
him. He really does his homework. It sounds like he talked to a lot of people to get the geography of London down in that opening chase scene, and beyond that, he's just a fountain of movie knowledge. Just, you know, like I said, names all the great heist movies, talks about Rififi, which obviously, you know, is another great business-like heist in a film.
Absolutely.
And he's fun, and he's a smart guy, and I always appreciate him stepping up to do one of these.
Yeah, no, he's another one I should have added to the stable of folks that I'm happy to see a part of this group. And Nick's also doing stuff for, I feel like, did he do the commentary on, who did the commentary on Modern Romance? It wasn't him, was it?
It was him.
Oh, it was him. Okay, that's great. Because that was the one we talked about Modern Romance, and I was like, this voice sounds familiar. Why do I know this voice? Because he's very articulate, but he's obviously very intelligent, and he speaks in a certain way that I appreciate, and you can just kind of tell that he knows what he's talking about, you know, and it's it's great. And yeah, that whole opening where he's just basically going through like the locations of where they are and how, I mean, he talked about how there's some people that are obsessed with this movie and that they've dug deep into, you know, finding all these locations, but I just thought that was really amusing, and I kind of wish that, you know, any big action scene could have a commentary like that. You know, it's just kind of fun. But yeah, he was great. I really enjoyed this one. It may be of the commentaries. Well, Cats is pretty great, but it's definitely one of the best commentaries in this group, I think, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think he's obviously having fun talking about the movie, and so we have fun listening to it. It's as easy as that.
Yeah. So that's a great discovery. I'm so glad that we both got to discover Robbery for this episode. That's a lot of fun, you know?
Yeah, it sent me on a little mini Peter Yates marathon. I watched, for the first time in a while, I watched Murphy's War. I watched Bullet again. I watched The Deep and Krull. So I just I was just in the mood to watch some Peter Yates movies after this one.
Murphy's War needs a Blu-ray big time.
Oh, big time. Love that movie.
Yeah, speaking of Peter O'Toole, that's that's good stuff. Or wait, we weren't speaking of Peter O'Toole. I actually recorded another podcast by myself today where I was talking about My Favorite Year. And oh, no, we were talking about
We're talking about the stuntman.
I'm losing track of all stuff. But anyway, My Favorite Year is also coming out on Blu-ray, just coincidentally, and that's
great. Oh, that's great. I love that movie.
Yeah, good Peter O'Toole stuff. But anyway, that will cover our sort of down and dirty stack of Kino Dis episode. John, thank you so much for indulging me and burning through a big stack like this. It was a lot of fun to talk about these. I would not surprisingly loved all the stuff that you had to add about these movies.
Oh man, thank you. It was just so much fun to collaborate on this. And like I said, have you recommend some releases that I might have missed otherwise? There's always a great reason to listen to this show and to do the show with you.
Well, same to you, sir. I'll say for the Roger Moore movie, that's good stuff. We got to do this again. We got to figure out some other angle here that we can approach. So everybody look for John on Twitter, The Last Machine on Twitter, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is your Twitter. Of course, head writer at The Pink Smoke. Definitely look for his work at The Pink Smoke. And yeah, look for the older episodes of the show if you haven't heard us talk about The Burbs, Modern Romance, Cabin Boy. There's definitely some others, but those are three of my favorites.
That we only talk about the best movies.
That's right. They're all good movies, man. Anyway, everybody have a wonderful and Blu-ray-filled week, and we will talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.